Singer-songwriter Nanette Natal has sung many styles of music, worked with huge record companies in popular music, and produced jazz CDs on her own label. Discovering her inner jazz musician was a surprise, but not her desire to go her own way and spread a broader message with her music and not just pursue that million seller. I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. Nanette's music is hard to define, but she sees herself as a jazz musician.
I'm definitely a jazz musician. I say that because of the element of improvisation, which is very, very strong in my work. Because even if you're hearing the albums, so much of that is a one-take, improvisational type of thing. But I've been in a lot of different areas of music, and I'm not a jazz snob, you know? So, I mean, I like a lot of music, and always have. But I would say that the primary element in my music is emotional connections. And that's what I go for. Feeling, being in the emotions, stretching my heart, stretching that element of emotion. How far can I go? How assertively vulnerable can I be? That's where I really test myself a great deal. That's my big test. And that's my big challenge all the time with every piece of music, whether I write it or whether I'm doing somebody else's material. I have to connect to it on a very deeply emotional level. And that's also that combined with the element of arranging, which I do. I'm an arranger as well, so that and a composer. So it gives me, it's more than just singing, so that it gives me a different picture when I look at a piece of music that I'm about to work on. But it also is, ultimately, that's really the base for me, that it's about expressing the emotions. And if it's somebody else's material, in order for me to do it, I have to feel that I'm living it. I have to make it like it's my story.
Mm.
And that means that the pictures in my mind when I'm doing it, the frame of reference, the place that I've, I explore a piece of music, I'll take it everywhere before I finally come back home again, you know, before I finally do it for myself. I mean, even my own piece of music. I mean, I may do it 100 times in various different kinds of rhythms and whatever, and then come back to something totally different so that I explore it so that I feel that I own it in some kind of way. And then I can be in it and find the truth for me in the piece. And so my context or my framework for a lot of different material that I do that's other people's material would probably be surprising to people where I'm coming from, what it's really meaning to me. It may have a very political meaning, for example. On the album Is Love Enough, that's a very political album. People may hear it at first listening and think that it's about love songs, which it is, but it's about love and various different aspects of love and the way the personal is political, the political and the personal.
Boy, boy, crazy boy, get cool, boy. Got a rocket in your pocket. Keep coolly cool, boy. Don't get hot, 'cause man, you've got some high times ahead. Take it slow, and daddy-o, you can live it up and die in bed. Boy, boy, crazy boy, stay loose, boy. Breeze it, buzz it, easy does it. Turn off the juice, boy. Go, man, go, but not like a yo-yo schoolboy. Just play it cool, boy, real cool. When you're a jet all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, if the spit hits the fan, you've got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. Your home is your own. When company's expected, you're well protected. Then you're a jet with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you're the swinginest thing. Little boy, you're a man. Little man, you're a king. But boy, boy, crazy boy, stay cool, boy. Breeze it, buzz it, ease it, does it. Turn off the juice, boy. Go, man, go, but not like a yo-yo schoolboy. Just play it cool, boy, real cool.
And so, like, for example, I do a version of Cool. The medley of Cool and the Jet song. And that my intention there is totally political. That's the intention that I'm working from. It's all about intention. Like when you look at a piece of music or you approach a piece of music, what's your intention? That's the first thing I'm really concerned with. What am I trying to say? Because I'm using words. I'm not an instrumentalist. So I'm using words, but I can use words in all kinds of ways. To get a particular intention across.
I love you saying intention. I'm learning a lot with this. Do you teach a lot?
Yes, I'm a teacher, yes.
Because I'm thinking that as an instrumentalist, I think of intention too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a great place to start because it seems that so many young people, myself included when I was first starting, we're so enthusiastic, we just dive in. We don't even think about intention.
Right. Oh, yes.
Our intention is just to play the hell out of that tune.
Right. You do 100 things and maybe one worked, you know?
Right.
But you try it. You have to try it.
Exactly. Yeah. But to actually, in a focused way, sit down and think about what your intention is, the energy that you put into it is much more focused and much more effective.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
I would think. And what is it like now to be politically aware and an activist and a social activist and all these things that you consider yourself, because this is a time that certainly people think they're politically aware, but it's not like the 70s.
No.
And you've been singing in a wide range of places and styles and all these things, but you still, I love that you consider yourself that. That's a big part. You go to your website, you read any of your liner notes like you talk about, Is Love Enough, your mm-hmm. CD. You have a really moving text that you've written about that. Talk about that and how that informs everything you do, which obviously it does. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that I've always believed that change, you know, real change in terms of society, politically speaking, starts with an individual. So that's always been sort of my philosophy. And it's a one-to-one thing. I mean, if you change the viewpoint of an individual, one person, you can influence another person and so forth and so on. So, and it all starts with that. I mean, when you look at, I'm not the first one saying this. I mean, even Gloria Steinem always talked about the personal and the political and the dysfunction, the personal dysfunction, and then the dysfunction of society. When you look at, let's say, a government, you can look at it like a family nucleus and realize, you know, there's daddy who's very dysfunctional, you know, mm-hmm. or whatever, or mommy, or, you know, I mean, you really can break everything down in that way. And so I do believe that. And always throughout my music, I mean, before I was doing jazz music and I was doing a kind of singer-songwriter period in my life when I was, you know, much, much younger, they were all that personal search and, you know, but again, it was about if I become a better person, if I stretch myself, if I learn to grow, if I take chances, if I face my fears, if I do all those things, I'm a better citizen. I'm a better person. And maybe I can touch someone else or influence someone else or someone else influences me. But it becomes that collective thinking.
Mm.
So even early on when I was writing, it was always that as well. As opposed to very overt, it wasn't I wasn't writing anti-war songs necessarily, but again, it was in that personal vein. And all throughout all my jazz recordings, there was, certainly with my own material, there was always something in it. If you really listened, you could hear that there's a double entendre, you know, and again, it's this personal and political. The difference, though, now is that in the climate that we've been living in, the last album that I recorded and released was It's Only a Tune, which is an album of love songs. And it's just, it's you know, it's a kind of homage to the West Coast sound. And it's my little personal, very little personal tribute to Henry Mancini. Very pared down, obviously. But I mean, that's my, you know, but that was my inspiration really for it. And it's just, you put it on, it's a mood. It's all these love songs of mine that were sitting in a filing cabinet for 15 years. And you know, it was time, and someone said to me, why don't you do an album of ballads? And then I was starting to look at all these different ballads, and then I realized, well, gee, I have all these songs that I haven't released. So that was a lovely experience. It was very pleasurable. It's a very moody kind of album. People really enjoy it. They put it on and puts them in a nice mood and makes them feel good, and you know, la la la. That was the last release and of an album. But then with the times that we're living in, I just started, and after Katrina, I just felt like I can't do this. I have to say something. And I've been working for a long time on what I would consider my most overt, explicit political piece. It's definitely a political play. I mean, it's not double entendre. I'm saying it.
and I think subtleties stop working.
And I think the older you get, the more you get away with, I don't know, the more you have the opportunity to sort of say it. So say it. You know, you feel that kind of fearlessness in a way with age, I think. And, but that, the incident with Katrina really just broke my spirit, just broke my heart. And I started writing, and I wrote I Must Be Dreaming, which had parts of it were part of what I was working on for a film that I'm working, that I'm involved with, about activism. But I added other pieces to it, and it became I Must Be Dreaming. And I really wanted to release it, and I released it as a single, which is an unusual thing in a jazz thing. And but that is because I really wanted to sort of join forces with, you know, same mind, you know, a similar mindset. I wanted to not just have my last work be all these love songs. I didn't want to... It wasn't about singing love songs right now. I wanted to say something. I wanted to, you know, be part of that, you know, that in aligned with same-minded people.
Relieved of state assistance, people meet such resistance. They fight hard, but still they can succeed. With so many factories shut down, farmers who've been let down, we all mourn the death of our American dreams. He's 14 years old, selling his body and his soul, and they buy, yes, they buy. She's not quite 13, a hard-hitting queen, doing anything she can to survive. I can't stay out of it, it just isn't right. There's no use denying the cries in the night. We can't live our lives blinded by the carnival lights. swept by the cold that curled in the night, fighting the suns in the hill. I'm not sure when the nightmare took flight, but they've made the streets their bed. It's time to rejoin the world outside. You better go ready or not. They were stripped of their sense of themselves and their pride. They were robbed of all that they've got. I must be dreaming. I must be dreaming.
My guest, singer-songwriter Nanette Natal. I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. After years of writing metaphorically, Nanette feels the current state of the world requires a more direct approach if change is going to happen.
I feel like I need to be talking about the world that I live in and how it affects me. And so it's no love songs for a while.
I love you saying that you can influence or try to influence or educate or enlighten one person at a time, that each person that we come across that we can talk. And you said that because I think now people don't think about activism in the same way. And now people don't feel like, well, what they're always writing about this and talking about, that young people feel like they feel hopeless in terms of that.
Yes.
And they forget that it just starts with doing one thing. I know that every, especially young, the largest, at least last I read, the largest group of non-voting people are women between 21 and 25. And so that's been my little thing. That I go out and I'm keeping track. It's my number of how many women I'm signing up. It's my personal little thing that I'm going after. And because they have so much to say. And I say, you can really count. And it's the same way I feel about jazz, because people say, well, nobody's listening to jazz anymore. And I said, well, if you're in the jazz world, you get your fans one at a time. We don't do big stadiums and do that kind of thing. And you're so passionate in your singing. And
yes. I mean, the thing is, I've never studied.
You just jumped right in and did it?
Well, you know, I think it was the instinct in me to be a teacher, you know, because I do that. And I mean, what I did when I was really young and wanted to sound better was challenge myself. I'd pick something that was way, way out of my range, and then try to build up to that. I worked very hard, you know, like when I was a teenager. I mean, I was practicing all the time, but I never had any formal musical training.
But you were working hard, and
but
that's what
I was working
in
my own
instinctual way,
you know, and I practiced and practiced and tried to get it better and trying to hit those tones higher. And then, you know, I mean, pretty much this is what I've done all my life. So by the time I was 16, 17, 18, I was out there.
Yeah.
And that's how I really learned. But when I say early, I mean, my beginnings, of course, were singing, you know, art songs and kind of semi-classical things. And I did do that in the beginning. And of course, it was all about having that, you know, perfect voice. I mean, I was listening to what a perfect voice was and trying to be that and expand my range by picking tunes that were two keys up, you know, much higher for me, and challenging myself and then trying to figure out ways to breathe and so forth. All of this eventually trickled down to a methodology that I teach now, where I have a very specific breathing method. It's a physical thing, and a lot of singing teachers don't really have that, you know. It's connected to improvisational music. It's connected to self-expression as opposed to preparing people for any kind of classical training. That's very different.
Who are your favorite scat singers? Because that's a tricky, tricky subject. Even I talk to musicians and some people go, rescue me from the person who's doing scat singing. And you love it. Mm-hmm. But to do it well is very, very difficult.
It is, yeah.
And who are some of your favorites?
There's one favorite. That's it. It's Ella. That's it. She was the queen of that.
Thank you.
Nobody could scat like she could.
And what made her so special to you?
Well,
with her scatting,
I think this she, and what also influences me with her, is that she always took chances. And see, when you know, when I think of the singers out there, there's Ella, and she could do the scatting better than anybody. Sarah had the most beautiful voice. Carmen was really gutsy and sensual, and Billy was just so vulnerable and innovative. And that's pretty much the group. Mm-hmm. Those are the queens, you know? and they each had their own thing, you know. I mean, certainly Sarah Vaughan scatted, but it wasn't, you know, that wasn't her thing. And Ella sang ballads, but she didn't have what Sarah Vaughan had.
I'll never be the same. Stars have lost their meaning for me. I'll never be the same. Nothing's what it once used to be. And when the songbirds that sing tell me it's spring, I can't believe their song. Once love was king, but kings can be wrong. I'll never be the same. There is such an ache in my heart. Never be the same since we. Same, never be the same again.
And Sarah Vaughan was Sarah Vaughan, so at some point she stopped taking chances. She really stopped taking chances. I mean, and you know, and Ella never did. I mean, I remember seeing her in her last concerts, and she didn't have the highs that she had when she started out, but she saved them, and she used them. And when she used them, they were right up there. And then she discovered all the lows at 75, right? And she was amazing. And she went to places that I never heard her go to. So that's an inspiration, because I think what it's always about to me in jazz is that you keep taking risks. You keep growing. You don't get stuck in your own, just stay in this style that you have and then be comfortable in that. You try to find the ways that you can challenge yourself and take those risks. So that she did. And I think that for me, coming up in jazz, I mean, I didn't even listen to jazz singers in a conscious way. Mm. I was influenced by instrumentalists. That's, I think, all, and she was too, and I think maybe that's part of it. Because when you've been listening to a lot of horn players, you know, they're improvising, they're taking those chances, at least the ones that I was listening to, and it's always about being on the edge.
Charlie Parker on Donna Lee. I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. For a discography of the music played on our show and a schedule of upcoming programs, visit our website at jazzinspired.com. You can email us at info@jazzinspired.com. To find out more about my music and what I'm doing, and to sign up for our email newsletter, visit judycarmichael.com. My guest is singer-songwriter Nanette Natal. Talk about Leonard Bernstein. You've got him down on your list of inspiration. This is interesting. Talk about this.
Well, when you asked about my influences, the piece of music that just kept coming up for me, you know, I was thinking back to being a child and what was it that I, you know, I mean, of course I loved all the pop music and, you know, I mean, there are lots of different music that I liked and, of course, must have been influenced by. But in terms of serious music, in terms of music, I think what made me want to be a musician, and I'm talking about knowing this very young, you know, 9, 8. I mean, this is all I wanted to do. And the piece of music that really came to my mind was the Hallelujah Chorus. And Leonard Bernstein's rendition of it also. I mean, I have other renditions, but I have, you know, Leonard Bernstein's. Because it was very passionate. And he was also sort of criticized for how he did in a certain kind of way, but to me, that's the one. It was so thrilling to hear it, and I must have been, I don't know, 9, 10, we're talking, and I tried to sing all the parts, and I memorized all the parts, you know, and I sang as much of them as I could, you know, and that was sort of my piece of music for a number of years, you know, that I just loved that, and that was one of those training things, in trying to sing the higher soprano part or the tenor part, you know, I was learning a lot, and I just played that record over and over and over again constantly. And I think that what it taught me was that the voice was this very powerful, deeply emotional. I mean, it was this powerful instrument. Because, and then that chorus is just so brilliant and joyous, and it just sends shivers up your spine when you hear it done well, you know? Even when you don't hear it done well. Even when you hear it in a, even if you hear it in a school auditorium, you just want to just go with it, you know? And so I think that was a very strong influence. And I never thought about that until you made me think about it. This was a wonderful assignment for me because I put a lot of things together, you know? But so it told me that the voice was powerful, terribly expressive, a real instrument. And then, as it turns out, of course, I mean, Leonard Bernstein was, you know, obviously classical, but he also was influenced by jazz. And West Side Story, again, right, became like, you know, and is still one of my all-time favorite, you know, pieces of music, and very jazz-influenced. And so early on, this was the type of music I was listening to.
And another one that I'm really glad that you mentioned, because it gives us a chance to play some Bessie Smith.
Mm.
Talk about Bessie Smith.
I just, you know, again, it's sort of like when people interview me and we talk about jazz and everything. When I was, and it probably was the time that I was young, it was different from now, but I didn't really know that this was jazz. And I mean, I'd be listening to Sonny Rollins or Billie Holiday, or I didn't really know that that was jazz. It was just music. It's always been about music for me, but I do label myself jazz, and I've taken the toll. I've paid the price of being a jazz musician.
You mean
musician.
Your career didn't just turn around and suddenly you were a big star?
My career was going off in a whole other direction very powerfully and very well, and then I announced that I really wanted to go into jazz, and everyone dropped me. My agent, my manager, and the record label, which was Columbia, interested in me at the time, and everyone, you know, and my when I made that announcement, my manager looked at me and she said, "My God, why? That's poison."
Oh, that's interesting. You know?
But why? Because the rest of, even though I had a certain notoriety and I was having all of this so-called success, I was terribly unhappy creatively in the business of music and trying to be pushed into being some sort of a pop artist.
Mm-hmm.
It was very confining for me. And when I realized that it was jazz, that's a whole other story when I realized that, you know. But it had to do with something that I'd been listening to since I was a kid, which was Billie Holiday doing Sophisticated Lady. And I didn't know that that was jazz, you know. But now I'm digressing. Does that matter to you?
It doesn't matter to me. I'm fascinated with it all. You're reminding me that years ago, I was probably 22 or 23, and I was playing piano at Disneyland and getting into jazz. I was hired to play ragtime, but I was evolving into a jazz pianist. And a wonderful trumpet player named Jackie Coon was sitting in with me, passed by, and he was much older. And we played the tune, and he got a very, and I thought it had gone really well because I was really starting to improvise. And he got a really sad look on his face. And I said, "What's wrong? I think it sounded really good." And he said, "It did sound really good." I said, "Well, then what?" He said, "I'm just afraid that you're going to like jazz too much." And it was exactly what, and that you're bringing this back to me.
Right.
Because all these older guys had seen in me, this is a girl who can go anywhere with her music.
Right.
And then I was entranced by jazz, and they were all, "No, it's over. She'll never make a living."
Right,
but
right.
Folks, don't be scared. All you young people out there and old people, anybody, jazz is great.
Well, it's free. It's freedom.
It is
it's freedom.
Freedom.
So
we'll
you know,
talk
there's
about
a
that. That's
price
interesting.
For freedom. And freedom doesn't come cheap.
Freedom isn't free.
Isn't it? No, it isn't.
But talk about that, because Billie Holiday was the one that seduced you into this. You said you heard that, and then that changed. Well, you were already unhappy with what was going on in your pop career, but you thought back to this Billie Holiday. Talk about that, because that's interesting.
Well, I mean, I was signed to record labels, you know, pretty early on, 20, whatever, 21. And I did a bunch of singer-songwriter type of albums, and I was a guitar player, you know, for a long time. So I was doing all of that kind of blues, rock oriented stuff. But I was always trying to improvise. But again, I didn't know, you know, I was always trying to double up and you know, stretch out and whatever. And of course, with the labels that I was signed to, they just, you know, they wouldn't let me stretch. They'd always talk about everything would be fixed in the mix. And it was all this, like, you know, restriction. And eventually I just canceled my contracts. I walked out of the last record thing I had, because it was just atrocious and where they were trying to put me. And I was trying to find my way. And again, I felt that my way was still around what I was doing. But I, now that I was free of the label, I was trying to put some stuff together, and it added piano player who was, you know, had a kind of jazz influence. But again, I didn't know it was jazz. And then Columbia was interested in a particular song that I, that they heard me do somewhere. I don't remember. I think at Buddy Rich's club or something. And they gave me like 8 hours in the studio to do a demo of this song. So I brought in a couple of tunes, and my manager, you know, was there, and everybody set it all up and whatever. And one of the tunes that I brought, so my own tunes, which were these sort of, you know, whatever this was, singer-songwriter thing. And then I decided I wanted to do Sophisticated Lady. Don't ask me why, except that, again, I'd listened to that album, that particular album, All or Nothing at All, and that song was on it, and I just was entranced by that. And I'm always entranced by Billie Holiday. She's the person I can listen to the most in terms of a singer.
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, yeah. She is the one that I can just sit and listen to.
Because of the emotion?
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. And how vulnerable she
is? Yes. Uh-huh. And the phrasing, the sense of rhythm, the spatial awareness, all of those things.
They say into your early life romance came, and in this heart of yours burned a flame that flickered one day and died away. Then, with disillusion deep in your eyes, you learn that fools in love soon grow wise. The years have changed you somehow. I see you now. Drinking, never thinking of tomorrow, nonchalant, diamonds shining, dancing, dining with some man in a restaurant. Is that all you really? No, sophisticated lady, I know you miss the love you lost long ago, and when nobody's nigh, you cry.
I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. I want to ask you something, just because you mentioned this in terms of people losing who they are and living in that world and going through that, because I've seen it happen. And I just saw someone recently that I saw them a year ago at the beginning when they were just taking off, and they had one personality, and I just saw them, and it's a short year, it seems, and they seemed shell-shocked, and their personality was very different. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it made me sad, because I wanted to slap them and say, snap out of it, what's going on? Do you think that it is the enormous attention these people get so that they believe their own press, mm-hmm. so they completely lose track of anything, so mm-hmm. they stop listening to their friends who still treat them like a human being? Mm-hmm. Or is it all the handlers who... Because I know in jazz, we don't have a bunch of handlers.
No.
We're pretty much, we have other jazz musicians who will either say, yeah, it sounded good or didn't sound so good.
Right.
So it stays very real and small.
And people,
you know,
are accessible.
I mean,
even stars are accessible.
Yeah, everybody's right there. But if you have many, many people saying this, it takes either a sense of yourself to resist it, even if you don't have a sense of where you want to go with your own work.
Right.
But... what do you think it is? Do you think it's all the handlers? Do you think it's all the press? Do you think it's everything? What makes people completely lose themselves and not know where they want to go artistically?
It's probably a combination of all of those elements, really. What I experienced, I experienced a taste of this and a certain amount of success. So I can then multiply that by someone who has tremendous success and understand what happens to them. First of all, if you're young, you're wrapped up in that. You don't have a sense of yourself. So, if people tell you you're fabulous, if people tell you, and usually the handlers are people that are going to tell you you're fabulous. I mean, people were telling me that all the time. I remember going up for, I did some film thing in the studio and I just did a little bit of, you know, oohs and ahs and whatever. And everyone in that agency, you know, it was a big agency, kept coming back, oh, you're so fabulous. That was fabulous. And it's like, it was nothing. But you get a steady diet of that. When you're a product and you've got handlers, you've got record labels and you've got PR people and you've got agents and you've got managers, and they all have an interest in your having success and they have an interest in your staying successful. And that means what that means. In other words, if success means that you work within certain boundaries and borders, then that's what you have to do. You have to keep doing that. Otherwise, they don't get paid. So that's a problem. And you can get right into that web. And then they're there creating this myth about you that I want everyone to love you. You know, these were things that were said to me when I was quite young, you know, from my manager. And I want everyone to love. Why? And I said, why would I want everyone to love me?
That's funny.
I don't think that's right at all. There's certain people that's going to relate to my music and, you know, but these kinds of things, so that people, you know, believe that. And if you don't have, if you're young, especially, and you don't have a good core, you can be swept away by all of that. And then I think that I would imagine, I mean, the amount of success that I had at different times in my career, more in the, the sort of pop world, was very overwhelming and frightening. I mean, when there was a time when I was doing things and people were noticing me, or where strange people showed up at my home, or I found that very overwhelming. And I did my own retreating, you know, regarding that kind of thing, because it was scary to me, you know. And I had an incident, actually, that was scary, which I don't have to go into now, but somebody appears at my house at 4 a.m. and I had to get the police and, a fan. This idea of fans, this mm-hmm. is a scary thing, you know, mm-hmm. that you are something. You know, I used to go on tour and find kids in my hotel rooms and, you know, just wanting to connect to me, sleep with me, connect to me, mm-hmm. whatever that was, because I was somebody to them, mm-hmm. but I was nobody. I mean, I was just me.
Well, that, I think what it changes is when it goes from people being genuinely interested in your work, mm-hmm. which is one thing, or being genuinely,
right.
or being interested in you because you're, quote, famous.
Right.
Because I know for me, I saw the change. I get not tons of fan mail, but when I get fan mail, it's always heartfelt.
Right.
And it's talking about the music and the experience they have with the music. And I got a big article, a really great review years ago in People magazine. And my fan mail quadrupled.
Right.
But suddenly people were writing to
exactly.
me from prison.
Right, yes.
And it
right.
went from
right.
interesting, intelligent about the music to somebody who's saying, I saw your picture and I can tell that you're a nice person. Mm-hmm. You know, those mm-hmm. you toss those out. Right, you know, right. I only right. have 30 years.
Right.
Wait for me.
Yes.
So,
yes.
you know,
that. And that's celebrity. See, that's a difference. I mean, we're talking about music. And really in the jazz world, there's very little of that. But in the...
Because it's all about the music. Because
right, it's
people
all about the music.
They aren't famous
unless
in the same kind of way.
It's a kind of packaging of, I mean, I don't, you know, I mean, but it's certainly in any other area of music, not classical, but I mean pop or rock or whatever. I mean, the pop world, you know, that's what it is. It's all this celebrity. And there's so much myth built on it. And it's like that you're this untouchable, you're the star. And look what it does to these people. It's very intense. It's really tragic.
You're... Creativity must have just soared, though, when you were unencumbered by all of that. Was it just immediate?
You could tell? Yeah. The best years, really, in a lot of ways. I mean, these are good years, too. But my God, I felt like I was on a jet. You know, it was like I was so thirsty to learn everything. And
now
listen.
You're a jazz person thinking about this at that time. Mm-hmm. Did you go back and start listening to jazz that
you'd
like
before? Well,
that's
when I started really listening to jazz.
And focused on it in a different way.
Yes, because that was the time I really started listening to Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald. After I had plenty of Bessie Smith, we started with Bessie Smith because I really have a fondness for the blues. But I mean, you know, I'd listened to a lot of blues players and my, let's say, vocabulary of jazz was a lot of Sonny Rollins, Stan Getz, Miles, Billy, but not knowing really, as I said, I didn't sort of categorize it like that.
And the horn players, because of that risk taking. Stan Getz, a favorite of my guest, vocalist Nanette Natal. Nanette feels it's a valuable tool when learning jazz singing to study the great horn players.
The thing about the scat is everybody thinks that it's shoo-be-doo and bebop, bebop-bop, and that's what you do. You take a bebop, bebop-bop, and then you make you do a little bit of a thing with it. That's not what scatting is. scatting is that the voice is utilized as an instrument, and you are making an emotive, non-lyric emotive extension of the tune. You're improvising on the tune now, the way the bass player has done, the piano player has done, and so forth. And you are an instrument, which means that you create motifs and you go places. And you know, maybe you identify, you know, different singers identify with different things. Like Betty Carter used to identify a lot with the bass, you know, and boom, when she'd do those slow things, you know. Ella was really, horn was her thing, you know, and horns have been my thing a lot too.
What about Sarah? To your ears.
To my ears, I think she put a, although I mean, I've heard some wonderful, wonderful scatting from Sarah Vaughan. I mean, don't misunderstand me. But I think that she focused a lot on the word that she was using as opposed to what Sarah did, where Sarah really
went out.
I mean, Ella, yes, sorry, mm-hmm. Went out, you know, more as an instrument, you know. I mean, because she'd do, shibidi-bidi-bop-bop, shibidi-bidi-bidi, you should use it that way. And that's a way to use it, too, because she certainly could scat better than most people that we do here, you know. But it's not about just the words, and I think that that's what a lot of young players, you know, get into. They just cop that, and they don't realize that it's their opportunity now to take their solo. And to really just, you know, express as an instrument. Mm-hmm. The voice is an instrument.
So talk about Miles Davis. You say he's your strongest influence and mm-hmm. teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say he was my teacher. Why?
Mm.
I think the same reason about the risk-taking.
Mm.
You know, he didn't... Well, he's somebody that... He may have had obviously had his own personal struggles and whatever, but, I mean, he didn't buy into his myth. He didn't just keep playing Miles Davis for the rest of his life. And people, certain critics, punished him for that and taking those kinds of chances. And of course, now everything he did was genius. But when he did it, he took the flack. And he just explored the music. And obviously he was a jazz musician. It was like, we know that. But he really, you know, he gives me permission, for example, to do some of the things I do, like the single, I Must Be Dreaming. There's a West African rhythm to it. It's very much based on a kind of West African drum chant. So there's not a lot of changes. It's two changes. It is improvisational. We're all jazz musicians. But what you hear is something perhaps that is a little more accessible, because in this particular instance, it's more the poetry and the words that are the emphasis as opposed to the hip changes. But Miles and the work that he has done has given me permission to take that license for this particular piece. You know, so I admire that. I'm inspired by that continually. All the chances that he would take, I take chances, not all of them work, but I take my responsibility. You know, it's my responsibility. Mm-hmm. But at least I take the chances as opposed to being afraid to jump in and do something different because it's, you know, it's not guaranteed.
Thank you.
made me feel, and he makes me feel when I listen to him. And I like music to do that. I want to feel, you know. So, yeah, I love him.
That's great. You're all of those things. As you were describing that, just walking in the door today, there's all this energy and life and enthusiasm for what you're doing, and it comes across in your music. It's so exciting, and I'm thrilled you were here today. This was great fun. Really wonderful to meet you.
Oh, thank you, Judy.
I can't wait to hear you in person.
Yes, yes.
That's going to be fun. I want to see how you eat up
a
stage. I know. I know that's there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Judy. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to singer-songwriter Nanette Natal. I hope you'll join me here next time when I talk with another creative person about how jazz has inspired their life and work. I'm Judy Carmichael, the host and producer of Jazz Inspired. My production engineer is Curtis Heidolf. The opening music was Airmail Special, and the mid-break music is a smooth one from my CD High on Fats and Other Stuff. The closing music is Old Fashioned Love from my CD Trio. I'm on piano with Mike Hashem on sax and Chris Flory on guitar. For a schedule of upcoming programs, to sign up for our email newsletter, or to find out how you can personally support Jazz Inspired, visit our website at jazzinspired.com. You can email us at info@jazzinspired.com. To find out more about what I'm doing and my music, or to order music that you heard on our show today, visit judycarmichael.com. Special thanks to Tom Rickenbach, Steve and Linda Plotnicki, and our webmaster Megan Lewis. Judy Carmichael's Jazz Inspired is made possible with generous support from our listeners and from Steinway & Sons and the American Hotel, Sag Harbor, New York. Visit online at theamericanhotel.com. Thanks, too, to Sag Harbor Florists. You can visit them at sagharborfloristandgifts.com.